Films include Sid Yiddish, The Girl Who Loved Animals, The Shattered Mind, and more. There will also be workshops and presentations to educate and entertain on the art and science of filmmaking. Again, that's the Portland Rising Film Festival, August 14th and 15th at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events. KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Montevilla Jazz Festival, Saturday, August 15th and Sunday, August 16th at Portland Metro Arts. The Montevilla Jazz Festival showcases the best of Portland-based artists, including the Alan Jones Sextet, the Ed Bennett Quintet, Machete Order, and Portland Jazz Composers Ensemble, and many more. Again, that's the Montevilla Jazz Festival, Saturday, August 15th, and Sunday, August 16th at Portland Metro Arts, 9003 Southeast Stark Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Hi, this is John Shuck, host of Religion for Life. And this week, we are going to explore spiritual maturity, levels of faith, stages of faith. And my guest is Margaret Placentra Johnston. She's the author of Faith Beyond Belief, How Good People Have Left Their Church Behind.
Find weekly podcasts on kboo.fm/religionforlife.
We were born before the wind.
Welcome to Between the Covers, a weekly KBOO program featuring interviews with authors of fiction and nonfiction. I'm your host this week, Leanne Kranz. Our guest in the studio is local author Ellen Urbani, here to talk about her Hurricane Katrina-inspired debut novel, Landfall. Published by Forest Avenue Press, a Portland-based national publisher founded by Laura Stanfill. And the beautiful, striking cover art is by local graphic designer Gigi Little. Ellen Urbani is also the author of the memoir When I Was Elena, documenting her life in Guatemala during the final years of that country's civil war. Her essays and short stories have appeared in a variety of best-selling anthologies, including Chocolate for a Woman's Heart, which she helped edit. Following Peace Corps work in Central America, she earned a master's degree in art therapy from Merrillhurst University, specializing in illness and trauma survival. Ellen is considered an expert on the emotional repercussions of bioterror and disaster, serving as a mental health specialist for the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. Landfall is her first novel. At the 10-year anniversary of Hurricane Katrina, Landfall reminds us of all the unfathomable things that occurred during the storm and its aftermath, and relives the human side of the story from Ground Zero, the lower Ninth Ward of New Orleans. It shows us all that a body went through. The story follows two sets of mothers and daughters whose lives collide in a car crash right after the storm, and two of them don't walk away from it. It breaks your heart in chapter one, and that is only the beginning of what author Pat Conroy calls, quote, a hell of a book worthy of the storm and times it describes, end quote. Landfall reads like a fever dream. Characters living and dead tell the tale, moving through surreal landscapes as time shifts seamlessly between past and present, heading down roads that are random and predestined, always looking toward the light and leaning toward joy. The book explores the extremes to which humans will go to survive and asks this reader to contemplate, what kind of human being would I be under such circumstances? The book illuminates again and again how the smallest, simplest gesture of kindness can mean the whole world to someone, can save a life. Welcome, Ellen Urbani.
Oh, thank you for having me. That is such a beautiful description. I'm listening to you thinking, oh my gosh, I want to read that book. And I was sort of getting carried away with your description of my stuff.
That's how it felt. It was a really wonderful experience to read it. I enjoyed every page.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. And it was just lovely. The fever dream, I think, is the way you described it. That was such a beautiful way to capture that.
Yeah, no, that after a catastrophe or a calamity, you know, the world just seems a little bit different, a little bit strange.
It does. It does. I've certainly lived through my share of various tragedies, certainly not on the scale of Hurricane Katrina, but I know what you're talking about, where kind of everything feels like it's rushing at you in full color. And yet at the same time, sometimes you feel like you're just floating so far away from all of it. It's a very odd way to be hyper present in a moment and yet so absolutely removed from everything around you. And I think most people who live through a disaster like this understand that in one way or another.
Well, you really captured it, and congratulations on your launch.
Thank you.
Is that your daughter calling?
It may be. I thought I turned off this telephone, and, well, I didn't. My apologies.
That's okay. It's KBOO Human Radio. So, Ellen, I'm curious, what moved you to write about Hurricane Katrina?
Oh, gosh, there's probably 1,000 answers to that. I certainly really empathized with the situation the people in New Orleans and the entire Gulf Coast region were living through when that occurred. I would have been there, would have gone down, except that I had a four-month-old daughter who was just trying to call me on the telephone. Now she's 10. Anyway, and I had a nursing newborn, so I could not go. But I felt very connected to that. And having just gotten back from Guatemala, where certainly the civil war was winding down but was still wreaking havoc in people's lives, I also knew what it was to live in a place and in a culture where trauma sort of came at you out of the blue, out of the night, where people disappeared with such regularity. And there was something so haunting about what was happening in New Orleans with the number of people who disappeared and who were missing. That reminded me of something I knew from a very different place. So I think it captured my attention and my heart and my mind all at the same time. And I find that that's the kind of thing I want to write about, is the kind of thing that reaches me from so many levels.
Mm-hmm. So the story begins with the death of two major characters,
right,
in a car crash. There's Rosie, a young African-American woman, and Gertrude, the Caucasian mother of a girl who is about the same age and has the same name as Rosie and same love of literature and college plans in the fall. And so I'm curious, why did you choose to begin your book with such a bang, literally? And why did you want to tell the stories of these particular characters?
The question of that's two parts, and that first question of why start it with a bang in that way is, at the time that I was writing Landfall, I was a single mom to two children under the age of two, and as much as I loved my children, and as much fun as I think parenting can be, there's also a significant amount of boredom that goes along with kind of playing blocks all day, or reading the same book 87 times a week. And for me, it was selfish. I wanted a challenge. I wanted to be intellectually stimulated. And so I wanted to write a book that was unlike most books that I find, but very much like the kind of book that I'm always hunting for, which is a literary novel, high-minded and intelligent and thoughtful, full of well-developed characters, but also a potboiler, whereby you sort of get to the end of a chapter and it's 2 o'clock in the morning and I have to keep reading and I'm willing to deprive myself of sleep. You know, Dan Brown's books are like that, The Da Vinci Code, where, you get to the end of this chapter and you just cannot put it down. I remember when I was reading that for a book group a long time ago, we kept describing it as literary crack, where it wasn't really good for you, but you couldn't give it up. And so I wanted to combine literary crack with literary substance. And so for me, I wanted big things to happen on a regular basis, but to characters that we knew very well and became very meaningful. So that leads us to the question of why these two particular girls. One of the things that that mattered to me when I lived in the South, and mattered to me and continues to matter to me, is kind of racial issues and the way those have been so ineptly handled in so many places, and the way they seep into our skin, even if we mean for them not to. I'm constantly trying to appraise my reactions to people, my reactions to news, for kind of these hidden prejudices that I mean not to have, but sometimes just sort of seep into me. And that level of awareness, I think, is something that's remarkably important, especially in light of some of the things that are going on nowadays. You know, with some of the police brutality we're talking about, I'm so glad these conversations are being bandied about. But they're very serious ones. And I think that if we don't look at what we might hold in ourselves that are influencing the reactions of the people around us, it's a lost cause. Mm-hmm. So I really wanted to take a white character and a black character and make them very, very similar, and yet show all the ways that their lives kind of diverge in many ways simply due to their race.
Mm-hmm. You know, the structure of this novel that we touched on, you know, you start with this bang, two characters dead before you even get into the story. The structure was really a standout for me because, you know, I found that one of the characters was dead in the beginning, Rosie, and it was such a unique experience to then get to know her and follow her journey through the hurricane and on the roads out of town, and you know, and to fall in love with her. I mean, she was my favorite character.
Mine too.
Yeah, and that was really masterful how you were able to do that, to keep the reader, to keep their heart open. It's broken, but open enough to then learn and develop real emotion for this character and a real investment in the story. And the story just keeps cranking. I felt more invested as I went, in a way of... But again, it was so surreal how you did it. Knowing she's not going to end well for this person, she's gone, but it didn't matter. And I then was able to invest in the other characters as well along the way. So kudos to you. Some of the scenes that you, the way you brought the living and dead characters together in the same scene was really incredible.
Thank you so much. I love the way you put it, that you know this is going to be heartbreaking, and yet you keep your heart open. And I think that's what I was just talking about, in a way, that with the structure, with the plotting, with the characters, trying to really put it in all of our faces, this idea that the most heartbreaking things can actually lead to our hearts opening. You know, the shooting in Ferguson and Baltimore and kind of the racial divides that are happening. And there's so much heartbrokenness in that. And yet, I believe what might come of it is a lot of heart opening. And it was fascinating to try and develop this book, both through the storyline and through the characters, to keep that kind of that message right up there at the front.
Very good. Well, you're listening to Between the Covers on KVU. Our guest today is local author Eleanor Bonney, here talking about her brand new novel that launched this week. It's Hurricane Katrina inspired, called Landfall, published by our local beloved Forest Avenue Press. Ellen, the Hurricane Katrina chapters are just nothing short of spectacular. I mean, Pat Conroy, yes, the Pat Conroy, called them Faulknerian in their powers. I would have died.
I just about died. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, and you really take the reader through the storm, you know, that house-shaking boom as the levee broke that morning, and the approaching wall of water, and the run-for-your-life scramble to the rooftops, and you reminded just how long it took for these people to be found, rescued, if they made it that long, you know, days without food and water. You take us back to the chaotic Superdome and that tragic incident on the bridge in Gretna. And you've agreed to read something for us from that section of the book.
And, you know, just a little prelude to that, though you've covered it magnificently, is that most people don't realize it wasn't really Hurricane Katrina that demolished New Orleans. When that happened, the hurricane actually had hit and passed and went around the city a little bit. And what occurred in that community was when those levees broke, it was flooding from the lakes and the canals around the city that caused all of that damage. So people woke up in New Orleans on the morning of August 29th thinking they'd been saved. Mm. They got up and they walked toward their doors thinking that they had survived. And that sense of elation was so immediately demolished by what happened after. So I'm going to read you a piece. This is from the perspective of Rosie, the young girl who actually has died in the beginning of the story, but whose life we're seeing unfold through that hurricane. And she and her mother made it into a neighbor's attic, and then they chopped their way through the roof, which is how most people who survived that flooding lived, is that they made it into an attic somewhere, and then they chopped their way through the roof of the house onto the roof outside, and then were either picked up by boats or by the Coast Guard. In fact, the Coast Guard rescued 35,000 people off of roofs. And that wasn't necessarily even the primary means of getting to safety. So it just gives you a sense of the vast numbers of people. So I'm going to read to you. Any other day, from the roof, Rosie would have had a glorious view. The lake behind them, the canals to the left, the city to the right, all her regular places, the places that made this home. School, library, washateria, Silas's superette, the playground 2 blocks over with her favorite red swing. All gone. The whole lower Ninth Ward reduced to some treetops, scattered roofs, maybe the top edge of the shoot-to-shoot at Bonnet Playground. Church spires mostly, and floating things in black water, pillows, cups, cats and dogs, dead, a chicken, dead, a bike missing its front tire, the hood of a car, a banister with rails still attached, a bouquet of waterlogged lilies cinched together with yellow polka-dotted ribbon. A framed family photograph, the big wall-hanging kind, someone's beloved living room centerpiece, with an enormous gash down the center, splitting the family in half. Rosie imagined somebody running with the portrait pressed against her breast, ahead of the floodwaters, when something sharp came up out of nowhere to slash the image sheer through. It had gone still but for her mother's singing. The howling of the dogs had stopped by the second day. No more sounds of other people, either. Just the three of them on the roof and 6 bodies in the water, all still flowing toward the city, New Orleans proper, ever the draw. None of the bodies was decent, all of them overexposed in one manner or another. An old man, clothed, face up, eyes open and glowing, bloated corpse bursting buttons, those naked eyes worse even than the naked bodies. A child, a little girl with pristine plates and a black Mary Jane on her left foot, her brown buttocks bobbing up and down in sensual aquatic dance. Rosie didn't want to see, let alone stare, but she couldn't remove her eyes. What kind of force leaves the plates and one shoe, she wondered, but takes everything else? They smelled, all of them, the dead and the living too. The floaters oozed gas, bubbles percolating between and beside their legs, remnants of last meals yet moving in bodies long stilled. The stench of innards leaking out, stale lung air, blood, uric acid, stomach juices flowing in yellow rivulets down dark cheeks, compost untended. A crow rode one corpse like a sea-bound vessel, screeching hale and hearty with a caw, 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 plucking offal from the host nose. In the hair of both the dead and the living clung the scent of fires that burned in places where the houses stood on soggy foundations, but the stoves, displaced, gorged their energy on the higher-up wood that had been spared the water. Could have been a crematorium somewhere out there, a burn bin for medical refuse, a pile of diseased organs set to flame, so said the winds. Quelled in the dead, unique to the living, sweat, adrenaline stench, the mephitic reek of fear. The water kept coming.
That was local author Eleanor Bonney reading from her new Hurricane Katrina-inspired novel, Landfall. Came out this week by Forest Avenue Press. Wow, thank you, Ellen.
You're welcome.
Whew, those chapters really chilled me. that crow. I will never forget that crow.
Yeah, you know, those stories about the things that the people saw, the things they sat there like an island all on their own and had to witness, were just horrifying. And I wanted to honor what they had been through. And I know that sounds like an odd thing to honor it by writing about it, not to make it a spectacle in any way, but to acknowledge the strength it took to hold oneself together while waiting to be saved.
Mm-hmm. You know, this book's coming out at the 10-year anniversary of Katrina, and it struck me as I read that, you know, the people who went through the storm, I'm sure, will never forget these details in the chronology of this. But those of us who didn't experience it directly, this is a very strong reminder at this time exactly what happened and what went down. And I think it's really important for folks to take another look at that. And
thank you. You know, I think it's an interesting thing, and it's a question that is coming up, and I'm sure will keep coming up, this sense of, is this not a Southern story? Does this story not belong to the people of New Orleans or to the people who lived it and the people on that Gulf Coast? And, you know, certainly I'm the first to admit I was born in Philadelphia. I grew up in the South, in Virginia and Alabama, but I've lived in Oregon most of my adult life, and I was not there when that storm hit. I have not lived through a hurricane, let alone that hurricane. And so there's sort of this, does that story belong to me? Did I have a right to tell it? And I find that a very fascinating conversation, a very fascinating question, in that I think the most we can ever ask of anybody else is to empathize with what we have been through. I don't need to be a man to write a man's story. I don't need to have lived through World War II to appreciate and honor what the people who served during that war did for me and did for the rest of us. And I also know in my own life that sometimes it takes someone a little bit removed from the story to see that larger picture and tell a multitude of stories in one place. And, you know, I don't claim this storm as my own. I honor the voices that informed me as I was writing it. They know more than I do. And yet, I hope that I have done justice to their story and to their voices. And as I said, I hope that it is received as the gift it was meant to be, which is honoring the strength it took to survive that storm and to go back and to rebuild their lives in that city.
And, you know, I think everyone in this country has a lot to learn from that storm, the response and the racial implications of that response. And, you know, I think it's in that sense, it's all of our story to really filter through and reconsider at this time.
Absolutely. And again, if we can find something in there to empathize with, we're that much closer to identifying how we might react in that situation, how we in a different position or a position of power might reach out and more empathically in the future to someone. And certainly we were all touched by that storm. I was 2,700 miles away in Portland, Oregon when it hit. Yet I might have been there, but for this baby of mine. I was in touch with the first responders who were there. My neighbor took in one of the dogs that was rescued after the storm and could not find, you know, or the owners could not find it. It could not find its owners. Even this far away, almost everyone I know has a story that connects them to Katrina.
Mm-hmm. And as much as this book is about Hurricane Katrina and the storm, it's, I think, equally the story of mothers and daughters. Mm-hmm. And you write so eloquently about the misunderstandings between mothers and daughters that can prevent us from being as close as we desperately want to be. And you highlight how sometimes when mothers try to teach their daughters the tough aspects of life, they can be rather tough on us.
Yeah.
And the betrayals and the confessions of this. Can you talk a little bit about some of the divides between the mothers and the daughters? And
certainly in this book, and I can certainly talk about them in my own life as well. It was very important to me in this book, in my last book, to speak as truthfully as I could, even in fiction. And I think that's an interesting, a whole different conversation, and it's an interesting thing, but how much truth resides in fiction, and how can you use fiction to speak to truth? And one of those things for me was creating these full relationships between mothers and daughters. I think that very often we tend to read things or even write things sometimes that gloss over some of the harder pieces. And I know in my life I have a mother whom I adore and who is as good to me as any mother could possibly be to a child. And yet we've had horrible moments in our lives where we, you know, we were absolutely disconnected and had to sort of climb and claw our way back to each other. And if that can happen in the best of relationships, because I really do believe I'm so blessed to have such a great relationship, it happens to everyone. Those are those universal pieces we all understand. And in the book, there's a lot of this backstory between Rose and Gertrude, the Caucasian family, where Gertrude means to do well by her daughter and is making choices that she thinks are in her child's best interest and that Rose hates her mother for, or almost better yet, fails to understand, right, and therefore resents. Mm-hmm. And we do this to each other all the time. I see in my own children where I make a decision and it's to protect them, or it's because I think it's in their best interest and they don't understand why I made the decision. And there's something that keeps me from being able to explain it to them at this age. And I think, you know, when they're 20, I'll be able to tell them this story and they'll know why this happened. Mm-hmm. And yet what you live with in the meantime is a child who's furious at you for in fact doing the best you possibly could by and for him or her. And that to me is such a tragic piece of parenting. Mm-hmm. And I put that in this book, and I feel like we're talking about the things that are hard in the book, and it makes it sound like it's this tragic. Well, I'm she sorry. Dies in an accident, and then all these people are trapped on the roof, and they disappear, and they die, and the parents. But what was really important to me is that I tell the truth about mm-hmm. that storm, about those relationships, and then also the truth about how those things can be repaired. In fact, losing a house is a horrible tragedy. But it is just a house. We can rebuild. We rebuild our lives all the time in ways big and small. And everybody understands that. And there's hope in that. And to me, that other piece of glue that's tying all these stories together is this sense that even in the midst of tragedy, we understand by that reaching out for the hand of the person next to us, something beautiful could grow.
And it really delivers. This book is not hopeless. It filled me with so many beautiful feelings and makes me want to call my mom
right after the show. You know, if you have time to repair those mother-daughter relationships, mm-hmm. do it.
You know, my mother, I read this book to my mother mm-hmm. chapter by chapter as I wrote it. And that was a really special experience. I had done mm-hmm. the same thing with my first book. In fact, I guess I need my mom as I'm writing. I read to her and it's been a lovely thing between us.
Beautiful. Well, thank you, Eleanor Bonney, for being our guest today. Your book is amazing. It's Landfall. You can get it at Powell's, Broadway Books.
Every bookstore in the city. Annie Bloom's, out in St. John's, all over the place. I've been very blessed. The local Portland community has gotten behind this in a way that makes me very humbled and very proud.
Do you mind quickly telling folks where they can come to see you in town on your book tour?
So I'm actually heading south on Monday and will be traveling through the south for the next 10 days, but I will be home in time to launch at Powell's on August 29th, which is the actual 10-year anniversary of that mm-hmm. storm at 4:00 in the afternoon. And then I will be gone again down the East Coast, but back at Broadway Books on October 13th at 7:00. And then I've also got some things scheduled for my very smaller local community in West Lynn in November on the 10th.
Cool. And you can learn more about Ellen on her website, ellenurbani.com. That's ellenurbani.com. Also check out some information on the ForestAvenuePress.com website. So thank you again, Ellen or Bonnie, for being our guest. Congratulations.
Thank you so much. It's been a delight to be here.
This song goes out to everyone impacted by Hurricane Katrina. Steve Earle, This City.
This city won't wash away. This city won't ever drown. Blood and water and hell to pay. Sky tear open and pain rain down. Doesn't matter to come when may. I ever won't leave this town. This city won't wash away. This city won't ever drown.
KABU Community Radio is proud to present The Yes Men Are Revolting as part of the KABU at the Clinton monthly film series. The Yes Men Are Revolting is a documentary directed by Andy Bickelbaum and Mike Bonanno, which follows the comedy troupe The Yes Men as they stage phony press releases and events to bring attention to environmental dangers and corporate greed. Again, that's The Yes Men Are Revolting, Thursday, August 13th at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kabu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
The revolution will not be brought to you by the Schaefer Award Theater and will not star Natalie Woods and Steve McQueen or Bullwinkle and Julia.
Is anyone fine in the state of Carolina? Is anyone you know of? Want a little girl to be all mine in the wintertime. And when the wind starts blowing and the snow starts snowing, you reach up and turn on the radio. Look out, Joe, you better take it slow, cause the chicks are ready to go. You reach under the bed, you grab a jug, take a little nip, get ready to mug. Look at your gal, you dig her in the sun to make a holler, I surrender, I surrender. Eyes smoking, shoot liquor to the brown gal. Take a tip from me, sweeter than Donnelly.
Hello and welcome to Words and Pictures, the comics and animation show.